I'm here with Alexander Mercurius, editor-in-chief of The Duran. Alexander, we had Putin's annual news conference where he fields questions from various journalists. These are pretty well-known marathon sessions that he gives every year, 2, 3, sometimes even 4 hours, where Putin just fields questions, a very straightforward Q&A kind of format. This one was interesting because he took a lot of questions, even though they tend to focus a lot on domestic foreign policy this session. And you'll get into the two conferences that he does give, the one from journalists and the one where he fields questions from people. While this one usually focuses on a lot of domestic issues, he took some interesting questions with regard to foreign policy and especially with regard to what's going on in the U.S. with Trump and the impeachment, Russiagate, Ukrainegate, and all that stuff. Let me read you a headline from Zero Hedge and three bullet points from Zero Hedge, which I think really crystallize at least the questions that he got concerning Trump and the impeachment. And then you can take it into any direction you would like to take it to, Alexander, whether it's the domestic issues of Russia, the economy, so on and so forth. But here's the title from Zero Hedge. Putin says Trump will survive impeachment proceedings. Russian President Vladimir Putin fielded questions at his annual end-of-year news conference in Moscow on Thursday. And while Putin usually talks about domestic issues, in this conference, he was bombarded with questions on foreign policy and relations with Washington. Putin said the Democratic push for impeachment is part of the ongoing domestic political battle in Washington. Point number one, Russia's Putin asked about impeachment vote against Donald Trump, says I'm not sure it's end of Trump's presidency yet. Point number two, Russia's Putin asked about impeachment vote against Donald Trump, says allegations against him are dreamt up. And point number three, Russia's Putin says U.S. Senate is unlikely to remove Trump from presidency. Alexander.
Well, can I just explain, first of all, what this news conference is? Now, Putin does two massive Q&As every year. The one we've just had is basically journalists, and they're basically Russian journalists. It's his big meeting every year with the Russian journalists, and this is done in the run up to his State of the Union address. Russia also has a State of the Union address when he sets out the government's program for the year and reviews the previous year before the Russian Parliament, the Duma, the Federal Assembly, because it's the Duma and the Federation Council, which are the two houses of the Russian Parliament. So it's a press conference with the media there. The journalists are Russians. They always have one person from Ukraine there for some reason, but they always do. But it's the Russian media. And what you tend to find, the dynamic in this kind of press conference, is that the journalists from Moscow, these are the big, heavyweight media people in Moscow, they tend to ask the big questions about Russian economic policy and about Russian foreign policy. And then you have all these journalists from all these sort of regions, the far-flung regions of the Russian Federation, which is, of course, the biggest country in the world. And they tend to ask a lot about local issues. So you've got a journalist from Kamchatka, which is the peninsula at the far east of Russia, not far from Alaska. She was asking, tickets for Aeroflot planes, for flight tickets from there. And you have another person from the Leningrad region in the north of Russia, which encompasses the city of St. Petersburg. And he was asking questions about recycling rubbish and complaining about litter. You have those local questions. And then you have the people from Moscow tending to ask the big international questions. Now, it must be distinguished from another Q&A Putin does, usually around the spring, in which he invites questions from ordinary Russians. And those are perhaps the more famous Q&As because they have this extraordinary ability to sort of bring up issues, and they can be quite emotional sometimes as people talk about their ordinary lives. And that's not the press, that's not the news conference we had now. These are with professional media people. So lots of questions, as always, about Russian domestic policy, lots of questions about Russian foreign policy. But interestingly, these very interesting questions about Donald Trump's impeachment. And what it shows is that Putin is extremely well-versed in the US political structures. He knows what the role of the Senate is. He knows what the role of the House of Representatives is. He knows all those sorts of things. He knows quite a lot about the impeachment process in the United States. Putin is also a trained lawyer. This is something people always miss about him. But Putin's training is as a lawyer. And he's looked at the case against Donald Trump, and he is as unimpressed about it as we on the Duran are and have been saying for a very long time. His point is, there isn't any real case here. It's all made up, his words practically. There's no chance that the Senate is going to impeach him on these nebulous allegations, these confected allegations. So Donald Trump is going to survive this impeachment, and Donald Trump's presidency is going to carry on. So an accurate and precise assessment of what is going on in the United States. One only wishes that American political leaders were as familiar and had as good a grasp of Russian affairs as Putin has of American affairs.
That says a lot. Yeah. Alexander, let's talk about Russian domestic policy and what's going on with the economy and other big issues that Putin was questioned about. What would you like to highlight in this video?
Well, I think, first of all, it was all fairly low-key this time. I mean, we're not talking about dramatic recessions or anything of that kind. So, yes, he talked about the economy quite a lot. He always does. I mean, he gets the usual sort of questions, you know, have we really advanced in, you know, beyond what the Soviet Union achieved. And, you know, he's always the person who has all the facts and figures at his fingertips. He can discuss all of this in detail. He's pointed out, for example, very validly that, you know, in the time of the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union used to import food, import grain and wheat from the United States mainly, and Argentina to some extent. Now it is the world's biggest exporter of wheat and grains. Not the biggest producer, as he was careful to say, but the biggest exporter. And he also discussed at considerable length ecological and environmental issues. I mean, he made fairly clear that he's something of a climate change skeptic, in that he seems to believe that most of the climate change that is happening, the changes in temperatures, are due to cosmic questions, in other words, the position of the sun and, you know, the pivoting of the earth and those things. But he's not by any means prepared. He doesn't say that, you know, human-made climate change isn't happening. And he accepts that there are things that, you know, need to be done. But he talks about, you know, Russia's energy mix. He points out that it's pretty green. In fact, he claims that it's the most green of any of the big economies, because it uses a mix of natural gas and nuclear power rather than coal, so that its carbon footprint is actually quite small. So he talked a lot about that. He talked a lot about the things that really concern Russians, and one of them is the resurrection of the Olympic doping scandal and the fact that they're trying to stop Russian athletes from competing in the Olympic Games under the Russian flag. And this time, interestingly, he made it very clear that he thought that was unacceptable and would go contrary to the principles of the Olympic Charter. So he talked a lot about that. And of course, he talked about other foreign policy issues. He talked about Ukraine also, and he had quite a lot to say about Ukraine and got quite a lot of questions about Ukraine, including from the Ukrainian journalist, who was, as always, you know, something of a troll. But that's why he is there. They always have this person there to ask the difficult questions. So he had a lot to say about Ukraine, actually. And in some ways, that was the most interesting part of the whole discussion. And last but not least, and it reflects both foreign and domestic policy, he also said that as far as he's concerned, the unipolar moment has ended and we're back to multipolarity. So good news on the economy. By the way, I should say that we've had more figures, more statistics coming out of Russia at the moment. They show, amongst other things, that there's actually been a rise in disposable incomes this year. Inflation is turning out lower than predicted. Unfortunately, that is now affecting because of it was all connected to an overzealous interest rate policy. It seems that, you know, industrial production is slowing at the end of this year. But overall, positive year economically. People are feeling better off. Not dramatic, but it's steady growth. Looking forward to faster growth later. But he's got his fingers also on the pulse of foreign policy change. And he had a lot to say about Ukraine.
All right, here are the two points that RT found the most important. And bear with me as I read you these this excerpt from RT. Alexander, you can comment to close out the video. So this is what RT thought were the two most important parts of this press conference, this news conference. During his major annual press conference, Putin was asked about two controversial laws regarding sovereign internet and foreign agents, which have been criticized as big steps towards having a closed society. The legislation, commonly known as the Sovereign Internet Bill, was adopted earlier this year and took effect on November 1st. It envisions a system that would ensure the autonomous functioning of the Russian language segment of the global web in case of a global internet shutdown. Critics of the law, however, expressed concern that the government might use it to impose strict control over the web, manipulating the flow of information and censoring online content. Though senior Russian officials have repeatedly denied these accusations, President Vladimir Putin has nevertheless asked about the goals of the law during his annual big press conference on Thursday. Quote, free internet and sovereign internet are not mutually exclusive concepts. The law is aimed only to prevent negative consequence of being potentially cut off from the global web, which controls are located primarily abroad, Putin stated, dismissing allegations of conspiring to impose strict state control over the web. Quote, we are not moving toward an internet shutdown and are not seeking to do so. Russia's president was also asked about another legislation that also prompted a similar scare of the state tightening its grip on the society, the law on foreign agents and its amendments. The law, which introduced the mandatory designation a foreign agent, was initially focused on foreign-funded NGOs, but later its scope was expanded to media outlets. Organizations designated as foreign agents are obliged to disclose their leadership architecture, their spending, as well as undergoing frequent audits. Late this year, the law was expanded again, now affecting private individuals too. The legislation still requires certain improvements, the Russian president said, warning about a broad interpretation of it, especially regarding private individuals, to not harm actual humanitarian work. The law was expanded to private individuals since foreign-funded organizations have been trying to circumvent the restrictions. They have started receiving money from locals who in turn receive cash from abroad, Putin explained. Quote, if you get money from abroad to partake in domestic political activities, say so explicitly. He who pays the piper calls the tune, you know. And if you receive funding from abroad, there are strong reasons to believe you are taking orders from those who pay you, end quote. Alexander.
Well, these things have been discussed quite a lot. These two laws have been quite extensively discussed by civil society in Russia. I'm going to say something straight away. I mean, the foreign agents law was introduced shortly after the protests that took place in Russia in 2011-2012. And there was a concern there that these foreign NGOs that were operating in Russia and some Russian NGOs, which were receiving foreign funding, were being used as a conduit by the West, Western governments, to try to influence politics, policies and politics in Russia. And of course, the reason the Russians thought that and were afraid about that is because there is a history of Western governments and Western government-funded NGOs being used in precisely that way in other countries, such as Georgia, such as Ukraine, such as Yugoslavia. So that was why that was that law was brought in, and it was copied on the US law on FARA. And it's actually radically different from FARA. And I can remember when it was brought in, there were all sorts of claims that it would make it impossible for Russians to, you know, participate in their in electoral democratic politics. And this law has now been in existence for quite a long time, and none of the dramatic expectations around it have come true. And by the way, I predict the same will be true of this internet law. The point to make about the internet law, the Russian internet, the so-called RUNET, as it is called, it's actually the biggest, I believe it's the biggest part of the internet that is not English speaking. I mean, there's obviously the Chinese internet, which is huge, but that's to some extent, to a great extent, cut off from that of the rest of the world. The Russian internet is not. And the point Putin is making is that they've set up the infrastructure in case the United States, and it's always the United States, were to decide one day to cut them off. And the reason that concern exists is because, of course, the United States has been sanctioning and threatening and cutting off all sorts of countries around the world, and using its position as the great internet, you know, producer to apply pressure on other countries. So again, this seems to me more like a basic precaution than an attempt to try and set up a Chinese-style great internet wall. I don't think this is part of the agenda at all. And I think Putin knows perfectly well, firstly, that this isn't needed, because Russians are very well informed about international affairs, but it doesn't make them particularly pro-Western. The contrary, if anything, is the truth. And secondly, given what a technically advanced society Russia already is, trying to establish such a wall would be politically completely counterproductive. It would annoy and upset and anger many people, and they have the skills anyway to get around it. So I think these fears about these two laws are groundless. But consider the fact that Putin is being asked questions about them at a press conference and finds himself obliged to respond to them. This is not what happens in dictatorships. Dictatorships, a president who is a dictator, who's intending to impose these kind of laws on his country, isn't directly challenged about them in a press conference, which is broadcast live on national television. I mean, that just doesn't happen in a dictatorship. So it shows again that Russia is a civil society, and that the president gets asked all sorts of questions about all kinds of things. And this is just one example. I'm going to just add one little point, which is, of course, that on the same day that Putin has been giving this great press conference and has been asked questions about these two laws, here in Britain, the government, the newly elected Conservative government, has just been unveiling its programme. And surprise, surprise, they too are intending to create a requirement for registration of foreign media organisations and foreign-funded media organisations. And they too are talking about imposing all sorts of legal requirements for that, and all kinds of penalties if that doesn't happen. So, you know, something very analogous to FARA. And not only that, they're even talking in terms of, you know, tightening up treason laws in relation to this sort of thing. And it's very strange, very interesting that people don't want to talk about that with respect to Britain, about, you know, how threatening that is in Britain, how that supposedly threatens democracy in Britain, even though, as I said, it seems to be that the British are taking it even one step further than the Russians. And they're getting so worried about it in Russia. And can I also say, there's not much debate about this in Britain. There's much more debate about this in Russia. Going to the specific points that Putin was making about the fact that if you get money from abroad and are engaging in foreign activities, you should declare it. In Britain, there is no such requirement. And one party, which has consistently resisted having such a requirement, is, of course, the ruling Conservative Party, which is known to receive considerable amount of money from donors based abroad. So there we are. You can make that comparison between these two countries also, if you wish.
Yeah, it's interesting that the US with FARA and the UK, they're doing this mainly so they can target Russian media outlets and Russian news. I mean, that's really why they've implemented these laws, and from other places as well, China as well. Meanwhile, you're looking at Russia, and they've implemented these laws that they can take on the NGOs, the NED, Soros groups, Open Society, and these guys who are constantly meddling in their elections and in their day-to-day work as well. Alexander, does it not scare you? Just staying focused on Russia, though, does it not scare you or worry you post-Putin that right now you do have a Russian president who is fair and who can, you know, keep the genie in the bottle with regards to these types of laws, whether it's the Internet or the Foreign Agents Act? What if you get a president after Putin who is not as strong or as measured or as fair as Vladimir Putin? Then these laws can really take on a life of their own.
Absolutely. Of course they can. And that's why it's very bad that these kind of laws have to be introduced. I mean, to be very clear, I would much rather not have these sort of laws introduced. I don't think, as they stand, they are particularly dangerous, but one can certainly see how they could evolve into other directions. But it's inevitable, given the kind of geopolitical crisis between Russia and the West that we have at the moment. I mean, the Russians are not going to let their defenses down. They've learned the lesson of doing that. So they are allowing, essentially, I mean, on a day-to-day basis, nobody in Russia, very, very few people in Russia are going to notice this. If anybody goes onto the internet in Russia, you know, young people, they will be able to access all the same things that they've always been able to access, and they can do it to a degree that is no different from what would be the case if they were living in Germany or France or the United States or wherever. If you were Chinese, that would be different. I mean, I've been to China, and I've been surprised, actually, how restricted access to the global internet is there. But in Russia, it is, to all intents and purposes, free. And these laws are not going to change that. But potentially, if things get worse and we get a less secure and strong leader in post, then things could tighten up. Or even if we do get a particularly strong leader, I mean, the Russian bureaucracy, which is, as you know, we need to watch it as we need to watch all bureaucracies. They could also see in these laws a green light or an amber light to start tightening things up. The one thing I would say where I think Russia is different from the West at this present moment in time is, firstly, there isn't the same kind of hysteria and outrage in Russia about fake news and, you know, trolls and media manipulation as there is in the West. It's very strange, actually, that the Russians are much calmer about all of this than Westerners are. You don't have these extraordinary, relentless campaigns about, you know, troll factories in, you know, West Virginia, you know, pumping information into Russia that you get in the US about a troll factory, in St. Petersburg, supposedly flooding Facebook with things. This doesn't seem to happen. And the overall trajectory in Russia since the 1980s is steadily for the country to become more open and more democratic. There's no room for complacency, but I think a new Russian leader who tried to go against all of that, firstly, it probably isn't needed. And secondly, he or she would be going against the flow. So on balance, I'm reasonably hopeful it won't happen. But, you know, the price of freedom is vigilance. We need to be vigilant, and Russians need to be vigilant. Two, if the democratic gains they've achieved in the last 40 years are not going to be eroded away. I don't think it's going to happen, but that's the truth. And it's not the truth just in Russia, it's the truth everywhere.
Yeah, the Russian internet is completely open, the same as the internet is in here or the US. I've never run into any problems when I've been to Russia, but I have heard, and we'll end it here, I have heard, Alexander, that when you do go to Germany or France, there are certain YouTube channels and certain sites that the governments do shut down and do block access to. This I have heard, and I've heard YouTubers
complain about
very big YouTube channels complain about how their viewers can't even access their videos in France and Germany.
Well, there you go.
I've heard this.
Well, there you go. So there, and that's absolutely right, by the way. I mean, can I just say, I mean, all these things that we've been hearing about deplatforming and demonetizing that is such a problem, becoming such a problem on the internet. You never hear about them in Russia. Nothing to anything like the same extent. And Russia has all the same facilities and infrastructure. There's a Russian Google, there's Yandex, there's a Russian Facebook of Kontakt. Yeah, I never pronounce it properly. All of these things exist there in their own way, and they don't. They're actually freer now than their equivalents in the West are. It's very strange. It's odd to see how things are switching places, and you're quite right. I've been hearing the same about Germany and France also. Not true, I think, in Britain, by the way. But in Germany and France, I've been hearing the same also. And it's very, very sad because France always had this tremendous tradition of being the great champion of free speech. They were absolutely the leaders in this after the French Revolution, the leaders in Europe. And Germany, of course, has a special history, which made the Germans for a very long time very sensitive about these issues. So if this is all eroding away in France and Germany, then, I mean, it's not good. And really, in some ways, very, very concerning. I think we've far more cause to be concerned about that than we have to be concerned about what's going on in Russia, where, as I said, this is a reaction to the sanctions war that has been fought against them, and to the very open attempt to meddle in their internal politics that goes on all the time. I should just quickly say that the democracy promotion community in Washington and London are quite open about the fact that they support what they call civil society in Russia, financially and in other ways. And civil society in Russia, the kind of civil society they're talking about, is not the type of civil society that I'm talking about, the kind of, you know, general interchange of ideas. What they mean are specific political groups and NGOs that have a pro-Western outlook, both about politics in Russia and internationally. So inevitably, that makes the Russian authorities, and not just the Russian authorities, a large part of the Russian population, very, very sensitive about all of that. But, you know, my impression overall, Russia's democratizing in the West. things don't look so good.
Yeah, and I would say pro-neoliberal kind of outlook, these NGOs. I mean, Hungary, Poland, I think, have gone along the same lines as Russia is going as well by saying, no Soros, no Open Society Foundation, get the hell out of our country, because these are regime change organizations.
That is exactly how they're perceived.
Hungary, Poland are in Europe, and still you have these NGOs operating to subvert those governments.
Absolutely. These are NATO EU countries. And, you know, their governments, which are, to be very clear, democratically elected governments, consider that they're being targeted. So is it surprising that the Russian government, which is not part of NATO and not part of the EU, and which is ultimately the target of everything, I mean, it's the great geopolitical rival, feels concerned that it is being targeted also? And I come back to what I said. If you watch and read what the so-called democracy promotion community say and write, they don't really make much secret about it.
All right. Alexander Mercurius, editor-in-chief of the Durand. Thank you very much. Guys, support this channel. Hit that like. Share the channel with everybody you know. It really helps us out a lot. PayPal, Patreon, Subscribestar. Please donate to us. Durand Video, BitChute. You'll find our videos there. DurandVideo.com is our own platform. BitChute, Alexander. Telegram is a Russian-made app as well. Huge app.
Absolutely.
Yeah, actually, but the same guys that did VKontakte, after they saw VKontakte, they did Telegram. So there's another app. You can find us on Telegram as well. Download that app. DRN20 will get you a 20% discount on all our merchandise in the Durand Shop, thedurandshop.com. Alexander, final thoughts.
Well, indeed. I mean, if I may say, can I just add that Telegram is a wonderful place, and we're very excited, not just about Telegram, but also about other platforms, including platforms that we are ourselves creating. We think that they're going to give us an enormous new reach. And obviously, I was talking in the program about, you know, concerns that lots of media creators, media companies, which operate in the Western media space, are now having. We will be protected from all of that through these platforms, and we are, you know, very excited about them. So by all means, search us out and support us there. And you can support us in all sorts of other ways. One of them, of course, is by going to our shop. And Alex mentioned DRN20 as the discount code. And you should remember that, because, of course, with that, you get 20% off on magnificent items like this. This is my oldest magic mug. It's got the actual Durand logo on it, which, as you'll notice, is a double-headed eagle, different from the equally excellent, the perfectly excellent Durand mug that Alex is holding, which has the coat of arms of the Russian Federation. It's a different double-headed eagle. Ours looks to the east and the west, which is entirely appropriate for an international geopolitical media channel such as we are. And the other thing to say about this mug, this is my first mug. It's the one I've had now for roughly a year. It's one that I drink from very, very often. You can see what perfect condition it's in. You can see that the double-headed eagle looks pristine, despite it having been in the dishwasher multiple times. It's not chipped, it's not broken, it's not cracked. All my magic mugs, and I've got several, are in perfect condition. That gives you an idea of how well made they are. And of course, they're light, they're strong, they're extremely well balanced. They keep your tea, coffee, hot chocolate perfectly warm. If you prefer something cold like beer or champagne, as I once tried at the suggestion of one of our viewers, it keeps that chilled also. So our magic mugs are tremendous, as are, of course, our shirts, like the magnificent polo shirt I'm wearing now, 100% cotton, beautifully stitched and put together. You can see the Durand double-headed eagle embroidered there too. And I'm going to be off to the Alps fairly soon on a skiing holiday with my wife and my dogs. And you can be certain that I'll be wearing my polo shirts at the apres ski and all the social events that go on there. And I'll also have not just my polo shirts, I'll have all my other Durand shirts, including my long-sleeved T-shirt, which will keep me warm in the alpine, cold, freezing temperatures. And of course, we don't just have long sleeve T-shirts, we've got short sleeve T-shirts, we've got V-neck shirts, we've got hoodies, we've got hats, we've got stickers, we've got all the things that you need in all climates, in all conditions, in all social occasions. So what's holding you back? This is the time to buy yourself presents, to buy presents for yourself, for your family, for your friends. Perfect presents to be found in our shop. DRN20 is the discount code. Alex will tell you how to get these wonderful things.
Just go to the durandshop.com, put the code DRN20 in the checkout page in the box, and you'll get 20% off. Alexander Mercurius, editor-in-chief of the Durand. Thank you very much. Until next time, everybody, take care.